Pleasure to come to New York for the...
Thank you, I forgot mine. You'll email me the file afterwards. Always a pleasure to come to speak for Meirut, which deals with issues so close to my heart, and particularly the core issue of the relationship between halakha and values. So I want to talk tonight about conversion. Conversion is a topic that I address really practically as a member of a Beit Din. All the hard issues of conversion come up for me every week. But I wanted tonight to try and reframe the issue not as a technical halachic discourse, but in terms of immigration policy, right? To have you think up front about the issue of what the halachot of conversion should be, as if the Jewish people are trying to figure out who should join, because that's really what it is, right? And hopefully that'll give you a different frame of reference for evaluating the issues associated with it. So I want to start off by saying that there are two challenges to the notion of comparing halachot of conversion to an immigration policy. The first is that it's not clear what Jews are that you're immigrating to. Right? Jews are in some sense a country, because we have a state of Israel now, which qualified by the notion that it's a state of all its citizens, is still somehow considered a Jewish state. And so immigration in some context is really about citizenship in a geographic place. And at the same time, the Jewish community obviously is international, and the international community and the national community can have competing interests in terms of the immigration issue. For example, the state of Israel's primary interest may be for as many as possible of its citizens to identify as Israelis, right, and as members of the dominant narrative in Israeli culture, regardless of whether that leads to identification with the international Jewish community. Right, so there are cases where the state might really be in favor of certain kinds of conversions. They're in the state interest, which are not necessarily the interest if you're trying to build an international Jewish community that goes across national boundaries. A second issue is that most immigration policies are decided by a central body. So you make immigration policy together. When it comes to conversion, the Jewish people have no single policy-making body. You have a situation that effect is, imagine if Congress decided, the Supreme Court decided what U.S. immigration policy should be, but any three U.S. citizens could overturn that decision and just get together and say, oh, no, you're an American citizen too. Right? So we try and form an immigration policy which is, we would say, radically democratic. Right? That modifies what you can do. In practice, what this means for halakha is that the distinctions between l'chatchila and bidiavad are meaningless. We could give many long and fun halachic discourses about how certain types of converts should be converted l'chatchila, and other types of converts should only be accepted bidiavad, but you shouldn't really have accepted them into the process to begin with. That's all very well in theory, but in practice, because information is shared, as long as there's one person willing to do the conversion l'chatchila that you consider bidiavad, every convert that you think is bidiavad will be converted. Right, so in practice, when you have a democratic system like that, there is no distinction between l'chatchila and bidiavad, and the only argument is about whether a conversion is valid or not. All the other discussions are purely academic. Okay, those are the challenges with comparing conversion to immigration policy. The advantages are, number one is that it makes us understand that every decision, no matter who makes it, affects the entire community. Right, when you make a halachic conversion, you're not deciding the narrow case. You're deciding for the entire community. This person is now part of my community, and you have to realize that every decision about conversion has that kind of broad impact. Secondly, and this is going to be a more radical position, but that relates to the theme of this series, it enables us to at least temporarily just avoid discussing the halachic minutia, and instead of discussing what the halacha is in detail, we discuss what the halacha ought to be. Right. This is the policy we would set if we had the freedom, and then we can go back and discuss whether the halakha that we wish to set is in fact textually justifiable. This, my friend Chaim Simon, is a professor at Villanova Law School, likes to point out the difference between studying the halachot of Shemitah Ksafim, right? All the halachot every seventh year, loans that come due during the sabbatical year are forgiven, and that's a wonderful discussion, but in practice, it never happens. In practice, what happens is that we have evaded that law by creating a document called the Prusbul. So often what that teaches you is that often when you decide that something ought to happen, there are halachic mechanisms for making it happen that occur after all the detailed halachic discussions. We say, okay, good, now we know what we can accomplish, what is out intellectually, but this is what we want to have happen, let's create a mechanism to make it happen. Okay, so I want to at least start the conversation about what should our conversion policy be. And then, if we come to some notion of what it should be, then we can figure out if there are insuperable obstacles to making it happen halachically, either because we ourselves are intellectually convinced that that it can't happen, or even more likely, even if we ourselves are convinced it is possible, we can't convince enough people to go along with us. So that it's an right? So that we can't, right? So that any policy has to be politically possible, and not just intellectually possible. Okay. Okay. Usually, my impression is not always. Usually, if one has a clear sense of what ought to happen, then in a healthy community, there is a way of making it happen. Not always. Usually, I'll give an example that Merle will know that in Boston, there's a restaurant which is the primary restaurant probably of the kosher community. But can't be under the Vod, the supervision of the central Vod, which I serve on, because it has to be open on Yom Tov. Now, pretty much everyone understands that what should happen is we should find a way to write a contract in which the store is somehow sold to a non-Jew for those Yomim Tovim. But as it happens, the Vod has a tradition going back to the Rav that we're not allowed to write such contracts, so it just doesn't happen. Right, that's a case where pretty much everyone concedes there is the policy should be that the primary restaurant of the kosher community should be under the central kosher authority of the community, and it just can't happen. But usually there's a way to make it happen. Okay, as examples which are actually relevant to this, ways in which we can make this happen. One is if you take a look at the opening Beit Yosef. Right, this is the first source in your sheets. So the Beit Yosef says that we see from here that everything, and by everything he means all decisions about what the motivations for a convert have to be, or what the knowledge requirements of a convert have to be, everything is all such things go according to the Beit Din's perceptions. A kol lefi ra'otenei Beit Hadin. Okay, so that creates a vast discretionary category. Now you might say, okay, how does the Beit Din use that discretionary category about motivations? So a number of examples of ways in which we can use discretionary authority about motivations to create interesting halachic results. One is, suppose I say to somebody, behold, you are betrothed me with this ring, Kedat Moshe Yisrael, on condition that I am a tzaddik. Right? Now, it turns out that we rule that there's at least a chance that you're married, because maybe I did tshuva. And in fact, at the moment I said that I was a tzaddik, 30 seconds before, I was an evil sinner. 30 seconds afterwards, I was an evil sinner. But at that moment, perhaps, right, the moment I said that I did tshuva. So that's, right, so we can speculate, right, we can create the presumption, right, that could happen in conversion also. At the moment somebody says, I accept upon myself the yoke of commandments, they meant it. Now you might say, aha, that's, we only create suffic condition there, we only create a doubt, but even that's pretty impressive that we think that there's a 50% chance that somebody did tshuva at the moment they said that. Another case which matters a great deal now, where we actually create a definite presumption, not a suffix, is in terms of the burial of suicides. And halachically, one is not supposed to mourn people who commit suicide, but in practice we always do, because we presume that they did tshuva the moment before they died. On the way off the bridge. I don't want to make light of it. Right, so there's a case where, in fact, we create a presumption about somebody's state of mind. So when you have a discretionary category, it is possible to expand that discretionary category if you really think the result is necessary. I'll give you one other example in the context of Geras. This is from Rav Kook, source number 2. It's response of Da'at Kohen, Kuf Nun Gimel. So, right, so Rav Kook dealing with a case of very contemporary case of converts who seem pretty clearly not to intend to be observant, and he has a particular concrete case in which it's evident that the converts have no intention of being observant. So he says, it's obvious that we treat them as converts from the moment they're circumcised, immersed, and accept the mitzvot verbally, and we are not responsible for reservations in their heart, as I wrote above. And then he says, a fascinating claim, he says, guess what? Conversion is patterned on the conversion of the Jews at Sinai. And did we mean it? We were worshipping the golden calf several weeks later. Right? He quotes a wonderful midrash which says, "Vayifatu b'fihem v'libam balimam." Right? The Jews seduced God, kibiyachol, with their mouths, and their hearts were not really with Him. So the conversion is patterned on a verbal statement which was not wholeheartedly uttered. So we can accept conversions in which people make in which people make verbal statements that that there's a significant chance they didn't actually mean. Now, you don't have to rule like this. Rav Kook's a radical position. Don't anyway mean that that this demonstrates that the position that all conversions are valid as long as somebody. utters the proper formula. There is a halachic principle Rav Kook is applying called Varim Shebelev Einam Dvarim, right? That if you make an explicit statement, then we're not concerned about what's in your heart. We just trust your words. But like every legal principle, it hits what Rabbi Michael Broyd likes to call the giggle test. At some point, saying that it's true is just so laughable you can't do it, right? So for example. If you take this was a real case once upon a time. Somebody goes into Beit Din with the intention of converting because they are a missionary, and they wish to be accepted into Israel under the law of return as Jewish, because that will give them immediate citizenship. So they go into the mikveh with complete and make the verbal statement with complete intent to refer to the Trinity. Right? Now we're going to say, well, guess what? Varim Shebelevin and Varim, they're really Jewish. Right? At some point it becomes absurd. The question at what point you choose to regard it as absurd is again a discretionary category. Right? You have this halachic principle which enables you, if you so choose, to say that the utterance of a particular verbal formula, regardless of what a person means, binds them. And you have the other option, which is to say no, at some point it has to be reasonable, and you have all the intermediate positions, which is what happens if you say a formula which can be interpreted both ways. Right, for example, this is the controversy in many attempts at interdenominational Batei Din. You have somebody get up and say, I hereby accept upon myself all the commandments that are binding upon Jews. By which they mean eating lox and cream cheese on bagels on Sunday morning. But as far as I understand the statement, that means, of course, they accept halakha. Right, so I can say, well, guess what? They made a statement that means I accept halakha. And so the fact that they intended by it lox and cream cheese, is irrelevant to me. Or we can say, no, obviously, even when we say Dvarim Shebelev Einam Dvarim, we still interpret the words in the way which is most likely to conform to their intent. Right? So you have a lot of room that way. There is an argument that you will hear often about this. Right, about this context where people claim that Rav Yitzchak Shmelkis, the Beit Yitzchak in the 19th century, was the first one who ever came up with the notion that we cared about the intent of converts. I just find that utterly, utterly implausible. There's always a giggle test. Right? Every principle has its discretionary limit. I find it inconceivable that in the 18th century somebody said, oh yeah, they intended the Trinity, but so what? They said the formula. I accept, right? Obviously we interpret it in accordance with a reasonable understanding of their intent. I should also point out that the people who take that position often jump on tshuvot which say something like, well, all that's really we don't really require people to intend to observe the commandments, they just have to believe that they accept the consequences of not keeping the commandments. I find that an intellectually convincing position, that somebody can say, you know what, I know that if I break Shabbos I am chayev skila, and if I eat on Yom Kippur I am chayev karis. And nonetheless, I realize I'm a human being and it will take me some time until I can stop being chayev karis. That's brilliant. But when you apply that principle to people who don't believe in karis, who don't believe in the afterlife, right? In a context in which the Jewish people have no sovereign power to claim, I mean it because even though I don't intend to do it, I accept it as binding upon myself because I accept the punishments, is often a deeply implausible attribution of intent. Because often the people about whom you're saying this don't actually believe in reward and punishment at all, let alone expect an earthly court to come down and punish them for their transgressions. If they believe that, then we would probably have to reject them on the grounds of clinical insanity, assuming that clinical insanity is the grounds for rejecting converts, which is a separate issue. Okay, so what's the purpose of immigration policies, right? Why do we have immigration policies? So one simple principle is we have immigration policies because there are certain people whom we want to come in, and there are certain people we want to keep out. Right? What those are depends on your country, on what your social positions are at one point. For example, most of you know that up until 1963 or whatever, something like that, in the United States, the policy was that we wanted Europeans to come in and we wanted non-Europeans to stay out. Right? And that was the goal of U.S. immigration policy, among others, was to preserve the ethnic balance of the United States. Now that framing is usually, in halachic terms, is framed around sources 4 and 5. So 3 and 4. Source 3 says that Rav Chelbel said that the reason we discourage converts is kashim gerim l'Israel kisapachat, because converts are as difficult for Israel as a scab, for whatever reason you want. Right, there are many, many interpretations of that. Some of them which claim that converts are too good; they make us look bad. Some which assume that converts aren't going to be observant. But that position basically is the slogan of the group which says that the purpose of halachic conversion policy should be to keep the wrong people out. Okay. On the other hand, you have source number 4, and Rebbe Lezer says that Lo Higa Kodesh Baruch Hu Yisrael Bein HaUmot, the only reason that God exiled Israel among the nations was Kadesh Yitvaseif Alehem Gerim, was so that we would have Gerim included upon us, which seems to say that the purpose of a conversion policy as immigration policy is to make sure that the right people come in, that we need certain kinds of converts. Right? So we can frame, one way of framing halachic conversion policy is we need to decide who do we want in and who do we want to keep out. Right? And just frame a policy around that. And if you were doing that, right, you would have two political parties, the pro-immigration and the anti-immigration policy, one of which would say kashim gerim l'Yisrael kisapachat, and the other which would say lo higla kodesh baruch Yisrael ben humot ela kadesh yitvaseif alehem gerim. And if you go to rabbinic conversion conferences, you will in fact discover that's what happens. Right, people, right, that there's a certain group of people who get up and recite the first makor, and there's a certain group of people who get up and cite the second makor, and everything else they say is predictable. As a result, because that's fundamentally how they're framing it. Okay, now there is a second purpose of immigration policies, which is either to regularize the status of residents, to make sure that everybody who is practically part of our community participates fully in that community, or alternatively, to prevent that and preserve the hegemony of a particular ethnic group. Right, so we can say that a purpose, right, we don't want to have a large number of non-full citizens among our population because that leads to instability. Or we want to make sure that we maintain the dominant ethnic groups. We want to make sure that those people who, for example, do our childcare and our housework, right, don't actually become voters, because then, right, because that would undercut our authority. The worst scenario usually from an ethical perspective are scenarios which policies that fail to prevent immigration, but prevent naturalization. Right? That, for example, the current policy of the United States. Right, in which we have large number, right, we are utterly ineffective at preventing people from coming in, but once we come in, we're very effective at preventing them from becoming citizenships, and that's how we create a large group, right, a large group of people who have no choice but to become a permanent underclass. This is also the case in Israel with Filipino laborers. Right? It's a very common scenario. Now, I would just argue that such policies are generally not long-term stable long-term. They usually generate eventually a serious confrontation, or a mass naturalization, or both. Right? You have a confrontation which leads to a mass naturalization. Right? Or else you end up having a war and you expel people. If we wanted to think it in classical terms, we would think about Mitzrayim, right? The Jews in Egypt, in the time of the Exodus. Right, there are a large group of residents who are not allowed any path to citizenship. Now, I wanted to say in a really provocative sense, I'm not sure this is entirely true. All right, because the reason that such policies are immoral on a governmental level is that they always lead to the exploitation of the people who are allowed to be there but not given any way of becoming members of the community. Now, you could argue that in fact the current policy of the Jewish community, from an Orthodox perspective, is exactly that. We are completely failing to prevent people from joining the Jewish community who are not halachically Jewish. Right? We are failing to prevent people from intermarrying. We are failing to prevent people from having non-Orthodox conversions. And all these people are, in fact, functionally part of the Jewish community. However, we are not willing to convert them. So we have, in fact, created a policy in which we have mass immigration with no serious path to naturalization. Now, it's not at all clear to me that leads to exploitation. because you know, even though we do hope that they contribute to Federation and vote for pro-Israel candidates, all that kind of thing, I don't think that rises to the level of paying them below minimum wages without benefits. But I think that it should give us pause, right, when we realize that that's what's happening. Okay, third purpose of immigration policies is humanitarian purposes, which the classic examples are family reunification and asylum from persecution. If we were to do the analogies in halachic context, that would be converting people already intermarried, converting the adopted children, right, of Jewish parents, and the Ethiopian and Russian aliyot. Those the first two are examples of family reunification, and the third is and the last are examples of rescue from persecution. Okay, the fourth purpose is public relations and proclamation of a particular set of ideals. So, for example, in America, back when I was young, it was still the case that people remembered a time when all school children were expected to memorize Emma Lazarus's poem on the Statue of Liberty. I don't know how many of you were made to memorize. Two. Three? Okay, not totally gone yet. Not totally gone yet. You know, give me your tired, your poor, right, your huddled matches, right? And that was a vision of America. It was a vision of America as a home of immigrants, that particularly resonance for the Jewish community, I think. All right, and that was right, and it was necessary, therefore, right, to maintain some kind of open immigration policy in America. And you could appeal to Americans and say to them, if you don't let people in, how are you living up to your own vision? All right, so the question is there some kind of equivalent in the Jewish community of the Emma Lazarus poem, where we say if we don't allow conversion, right, or if we do allow conversion, somehow it violates an ideal which is central to our self-perception. So I wanted to give you a source that I'm very, very fond of. This is source number 9 on the sheet. So this is from Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Zichrono Livracha. Some of you who have not heard of him, he was the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva Tor Vadas up until the 80s. His sons are currently, one of his sons is the head of the Yeshiva Gedol in Philadelphia. He's a member of the Moetzos Gedolei HaTorah. Right? He was a prominent figure in what is now known as Haredi, right, as Haredi Orthodoxy. So this is from the recollected transcriptions of his lectures on Pirkei Avot. So on Mishnah Avot Aleph Yud Aleph, which is the statements recorded in the names of Shemaya and Naftalion. So he tells us, incidentally, we see from this mission an important principle of Jewish thought. Even though Shemaya and Naftali were converts, they were able to reach offices as high as head of the Sanhedrin and president, the pinnacles of national leadership. This was so because our perspective is that all human beings are created as Tzelem Elokim, and all of them are dear to God. But the children of Israel who accepted upon themselves the Torah of God and His commandments have unique closeness with God. Therefore, if an individual non-Jew comes and accepts upon himself or herself the observance of the Torah, he or she is a full Jew and becomes part of the chosen nation. Here is contained the response to those who claim that the Jewish religion is a racist religion, God forbid. They claim that when we say, Atah b'chartanu mikolo amim, it seems that we are exalting ourselves above the other nations of the world, as if we were uniquely good. But the truth is certainly the opposite, because they believe that a person cannot join their nation if he was born into another nation, as the Germans claim to be the best race. But we believe that our chosenness stems solely from our being subject to additional commandments, and anyone who accepts upon himself or herself the yoke of heaven is absolutely able to join our nation and is called by the name of Israel. Okay, so Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky makes it a claim that we accept the notion that racism is wrong, that central to our vision of ourselves as a people whose uniqueness is grounded in responsibility as opposed to in ethnocentrism, is the possibility of conversion. Okay? So I would try and take that, right, Rebecca Kamenetsky's statement as the equivalent of Emma Lazarus's poem. Right, that there has to be a possibility of conversion, and I would argue, although I have to say that this failed with some new family members at dinner recently, but I'll try it again, that there is the Gemara takes the position that there is a drasha from the word Lidurot Techem that teaches us that conversion always has to be possible. That's why we allow conversion, even though halachic conversion deoraita biblically requires the convert to bring a sacrifice in order to complete the conversion. And we should say, well, guess what? No temple, no sacrifice, no conversion. But we say, no, can't be. Right? The word L'dorotechem teaches us that conversion always has to be possible. And I want to argue that's because if we created a situation in which conversion was impossible, we would open ourselves to the critique that the notion of chosenness is a racial category and not a responsibility category. Because why can't other people accept the same responsibility? So that's an argument for the necessity of allowing conversion. But what I want to point out is that that has implications in terms of access, but it doesn't have necessarily implications lakula in terms of standards. Quite the reverse. Right, if you say the reason we have to allow conversion is because otherwise we would be saying that Judaism depends entirely on ethnicity rather than on acceptance of responsibility, how can you convert people who don't accept that responsibility? And why would it be worthwhile to convert people who don't accept that responsibility? So if you take a look at source 7, for example, the source 7 is Rav Ben Tzion Aziel's, first Sephardi Rav Rashi, whose Tshuvot you should all learn extensively, because they're spectacular Tshuvot, and I think it's a major desideratum to get his Tshuvot quoted more and more often in halachic discourse, because he'd kind of fallen out, and that was a deliberate choice. Some people stopped quoting him on purpose, and we really need to get him quoted more and more often. Nonetheless, in this case, I want to point out, so this is one of the most lenient positions on conversion. He says that you should convert patrilineal Jews, right, even if you don't expect them really to be from, because after all, they are Zera Yisrael, right? They're Jewish seeds. How can you allow Jewish seeds to be lost to the Jewish people? There's all sorts of beautiful rhetoric about how terrible it would be. If anybody with any drop of of Jewish genetics would be lost to the Jewish people. Now that has, right, if you want to take a lenient position on conversion now, particularly conversion of patrilineals, this is the tshuva you want. But on the other hand, it doesn't work with Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky at all. It's built entirely on a genetic vision of Judaism. The other tshuva, which is probably the most common source for really lenient contemporary positions about conversion, is a wild tshuva of Moshe Feinstein about the day school in Indianapolis. The day school in Indianapolis had a largely Orthodox staff, but it was a community school. And at some point, the teachers discovered that most of the kids in the school were not halachically Jewish, at least by their standards. Most of the kids in the school were children either of Gentile mothers or of mothers who had non-Orthodox conversions. And they came to Rav Moshe, and they said to him, what are we going to do now? They were under the impression they were not allowed to teach Torah to non-Jews, and therefore they thought they all had to resign. So Rav Moshe sent them back a tshuva in which he said, I don't believe this was ever implemented, but Rav Moshe sent them back a tshuva in which he says, I don't see the issue, just convert them all. They're not going to be from, because in fact, even though they went to Orthodox, they're not going to be from. So Rav Moshe ends up saying one of two things. First of all, he seems to suggest a wild position that since we take the notion, this he says implicitly, and in other tshuvot he contradicts this, so I'm telling you this is a constructed position, that all American Jews are tinoko chenishbu, they're considered to be captive infants, and so they're not really responsible for their decisions. But he says they're only not responsible for their bad decisions. Obviously they get credit for their good decisions, so therefore if we convert them, it's going to be to their benefit because their mitzvot will count and their averot won't. So we can convert them as children because it's in their best interest. And then secondly, he says, and by the way, just having the sanctity of Israel is a benefit. Even without the, right, what about the responsibility? Just having the sanctity of Israel is a benefit. Right? And that's why you can convert children. Right? Moshe seems to believe really that, you know, that you can just randomly convert, right, convert children en masse as long as you don't have parental objection. If you take this tshuva really at face value. Whether you take the tshuva at face value or not, it is certainly a position that has real ramifications for those people who want to convert all the children of the Russian Olim in Israel, because that's in the demographic interest of the state of Israel, is not to generate another minority that doesn't identify as Jewish. If you want to do that, this is the tshuva that you're going to pull out. But recognize that it's built on an entirely different conception of entirely different conception of conversion, and that raises the issue which has to go on. Right, one issue is how values affect halacha. But values can affect halacha in two different ways. One way is that values could affect halacha in terms of the rationales you use for particular laws, and the other is rationales can affect law on the policy level. It happens often that in order to achieve the policy goal you want, you have to rely on halachic arguments that rest on entirely opposite presumptions. Like, for example, you might feel that you want to generate lenient conversion policies because of some kind of notion that you don't feel so strongly about chosenness. But the only way to get there, right, halachically, is to rely on positions that take chosenness as a central category, such that of course it's a benefit for everybody to be Jewish, no matter what else happens, because they'll be in a closer circle to God and Gan Eden after all. Right, so you have to be aware when you talk about the interplay of values and halacha, you have to decide if you're going to rely on them as to like which shita depends on a position that I agree with, or which shita yields the result that in the contemporary world, right, is the outcome I want to agree with. Okay, I want to quickly do one other axis and then reach conclusions. The other axis, and this is the way I've given this shir in the past, is just should realize that whenever you have a gerus shaila, you have to think about four different constituencies. You have to think about the constituency of the Jewish community and your sub-communities, and I think the primary interest in that level is always going to be that every sub-community wants every member of it recognized by all other sub-communities. Right, that's the answer. So you want to figure out, right, so for example, right, if I convert somebody, right, and I say, okay, good, this person, what will happen to my community if this person is converted? What will happen is, since that community won't accept this person, then that community will then, right, have reason to distrust the Jewishness of every member of my community, since they can no longer trust that every member of my community is Jewish. Right, so that's a really powerful thing you have to consider, that every time, right, that you have an interest in your sub-community of creating a context in which every member of your sub-community is automatically accepted by all the other sub-communities you care about, and that can often be a very serious constraint on your behavior. When you decide whether to do a conversion that will be considered questionable, you're not just deciding whether to put this person into limbo. Putting this person into limbo may retrospectively put lots of other people into limbo. Right, so that's an issue you really have to think about. You also, of course, have interest both in your community's olam hazeh, which means that if you convert lots and lots of really poor people, or lots and lots of mentally ill people, that will be a huge drain on communal resources. And any normal immigration policy would think about that. Maybe we do, maybe we don't. And you're also entitled to think about your olam haba. Right, if you think on Yom Kippur the entire community is judged as a whole, so then, you know, you want to convert people who add to the positive side of your balance sheet. Right? It's a bad idea to convert mass murderers, no matter how sincere. Because God presumably frowns on them, and maybe it's a bad idea to convert Mechalei Shabbos, because that does bad things to your balance sheet. Right? Presuming that you know how God keeps score. Okay, secondly, you have to consider the interests of the specific person in front of you. Are they stable? Will this be good for their health? Right? For example, many people who come to Converge present with OCD. Right. So now you have to think about, right, is that now OCD? You should all know, right, is not more prevalent in the Orthodox community than other communities. That's what that is. It's just that if you're Orthodox, the way your OCD manifests is through halacha. Right. Right. This just happens because it finds its outlet. But if you're already OCD. So then there is an attraction to a system that has a lot of rules and tells you exactly what to do. So you have to figure out, but that can also lead, you know, like for example, one of the most common manifestations of OCD is obsessive washing. Right, now it's very, now, right, now my friend Dr. Jonathan Huppert, who's written the article on this subject with Jed Siv, has it's an interesting thing which he tries to imagine a secular therapist trying to distinguish between somebody following Hilchot and Tilat Yadayim and somebody being OCD. You have to take the water and fill it in the left hand, right? Fill the cup with the left hand, then transfer it to the right hand, making sure that none of the water spills, right? Then you pour it in this order, right? It has to be exactly this much amount, and if anything gets on you, you have to start all over. But you have to figure out whether converting people is going to deal with people who are who have that kind of thing, people who can't leave the room ever without they have to keep going in infinite loops to see whether they lock the door or not, right? So what happens to them when they try and remember whether they said Mashiv Ruachim or Regeshim? This is a very common shaila, by the way. Very, very common shaila. I'm sure all of you have had. I had friends who took an hour and a half to say Kriyat Shema in the morning because they could never figure out whether it said Laman Tizkeru or Laman Tizkeru. So you have to think about that. You think about they're going to be happy. You have to think about again whether they're going to whether they're if you have somebody, let's say, who's poised for a career as a professional baseball player. It's hard to be a professional baseball player if you don't play on Shabbos. So you have to figure out, that they're going to be poor. Maybe that, a lot poorer than they would otherwise have been. And the same with their Olam Haba and the health of their marriage, all that kind of thing. Okay, so you have a constituency of halakha, right? You want the public image of halakha to be rigorous, consistent, and humane. And sometimes, whatever good reasons you have for converting somebody or not converting somebody, the public relations image of it is going to be that you are arbitrary and cruel. And that's a real consideration. You don't want people to lose faith such that they have in the conversion process. Right? You want to maintain the authority of halakha. If people see halakha as arbitrary, then they stop respecting it. You want to maintain the capacity of halakha to resist dishonest or incompetent interpreters. And that's really a very big issue because, again, there are standards that it would be a good idea to say you could take this standard. The problem is that in the absence of a central authority, that standard leaves open the room for people who will say, well, for $50,000, right, I will declare that I know that you had intent at the moment that you said the verbal formula, right? And how do you distinguish between that and somebody who really thinks that? Right, I get calls regularly from people who say, I'm calling you, and they should know the last person I called said to me that for X amount of dollars, right, they would convert me. But it felt dirty to me, so I wanted to come and find out if there's a way I could do it through you. Now those are the people who it felt dirty to. Lots of other people presumably didn't. And they just went ahead and did it. They don't call me. And they may go back to them after I say no also. The last thing is, and this is something that I care very deeply about, in addition to halakha appearing humane, halakha should also actually be humane. Right? And one of the things, right, and so sometimes you have to look at it and say, you know what, this l'chatchila, this shouldn't happen, but we're in a situation where we're just going to ruin somebody's life. Right, let's say, right, very common scenario, you have a bunch of kids who have been sent to day school, love from kite, but but their mother, for some reason, isn't a viable conversion candidate. Because their psychological stability is weak, right, because they're just really not going to be able to keep it up. But it's really a bad thing to convert the kids and not the mother. So do you drop your standards because it's just inhumane? It's inhumane to tell the kids you can't convert because we can't convert your mother, when the kids have been raised that way. Right? So it might be that kind of pressure, right? Just the halakha should actually be humane affects you as well. And finally, right? And this is something that we should be stressed more, but this year we don't have time for is that you have to be honest with yourself, which means that you have to only make decisions that you believe are halakhically defensible. You can't paskin based on a shita that you think is ridiculous because you think it works out well. Right? If you think it's ridiculous, you just can't paskin that way. And the same token, you have to not make decisions that you find ethically defensible, right? If you think that this is a valid shita, and so I could paskin that way, but it would really be evil, then don't do it. Okay. Last part that I want to talk about, bottom line for me. Right? What kind of things matter to me? There is an argument which you find often in the Federation community that we need conversion policy to be determined on the basis of continuity or numbers. So I'll be frank, I just don't care. If we can't sustain ourselves through our children, I'm not so interested in launching a conversion campaign. Uh, and I don't believe that the survival of Jewry generally really is a demographic issue, and I don't have a theological issue requiring the Jewish community to survive in a particular geographic area. Right? If it turns out that the Jewish community in America can't sustain itself, but Judaism will go on perfectly well in Israel and Bulgaria, right? So the U.S. community doesn't survive, so what? Doesn't bother me. Okay. However, the issue about what the demographics in the state of Israel does really matter to me, although it's interesting to figure out how that should matter religiously, right? To what degree there was an editorial in Haaretz, which somebody said, you know, what's happened in the Israeli Supreme Court decision is the rabbis stopped believing that the values of Zionism trump Talacha. I don't think I ever wanted to start believing that, but at the same time, I think the value of Zionism plays a role in Halacha. And it's a really interesting question, to what degree the interests of the state play a role in halachic decision-making. Okay, there is what we might call the practical anti-Semitism argument. Right? The more people from non-Jewish backgrounds who are associated with Jews, the more likely they won't be anti-Semitic. But the truth is, this is a better argument for encouraging unconverted intermarriage than for encouraging conversion. And we don't seem to want to go there. So it doesn't seem like a good argument for conversion to me. Okay. The question of the intermarriageability of people who identify as Jews does matter to me, right? Jews should be able to marry each other, although I should point out that my colleague, Rabbi Norman Janus, always points out in this context that we have a perek, the last perek of Masechet Kiddushin is called Asar Yuchsin, right? It gives you a list of genealogical groups of Jews in the original Aliyah from Bavel, right, to start the Second Temple, who couldn't marry each other. So we have survived in the past with identified Jewish communities being completely unable to marry each other. Whole cities were declared Mamzerim. So, while that argument has a lot of appeal to me, I have to recognize Rabbi Janus's point that it doesn't work so well historically. In any case, there's nothing we can do right now that will create that because of the patrilineal issue. Right? Even if we created a common conversion standard, that wouldn't solve the patrilineal issue. So I don't think we have a chance of making all Jews intermarriageable with each other by a conversion policy. Okay, now the conversion of the question of the intermarriageability of Orthodox Jews specifically really does matter to me. And I think that there's a halachic way of framing that, which is lo tisgo to do, but you really don't want the community that accepts halacha as binding to factionalize. And creating a situation in which Orthodox Jews can't marry each other strikes me as a real violation of that. Now, whenever you have that issue of factionalization, you have to decide, is there another value that's more important? Right? Because that argument militates against us adopting as a community a conversion standard that would not be accepted by the Haredi world. Right? It basically means from its common denominator wins about conversion. Right? And that's an issue. We have to figure out whether we want that. I think you have to understand the real cost of creating a community that is non-intermarriageable, but maybe there's a value that overcomes it. So decide, you know, that's an issue that really has to be decided. I should advertise this for myself. This Saturday night I'm going to give a lecture called What Should Modern Orthodoxy Be? Which will address that kind of issue much more in depth. And if you can't be in Boston to hear it, then I encourage you to go to the website later and listen to the audio. Okay, what I think really the issues that matter most to me when we think about the role of values in halakha are the human costs associated with standards on the one hand. So the cases that really bother me are when non-frum couples come and ask you, non-frum infertile couples come and ask you, right, if you can convert their child, which under the current standards of the RCA you cannot, unless they commit to 12 years of Orthodox day school and Shemirat Shabbat and Kashrut in the home. You know, when you get child, as if somebody's been head of federation for the past 10 years and they're going to send their kid to a shechter. Right, that's a really hard. When you have people, they're Jews, they're committed Jews. And they can't have natural children. To tell them you can't convert their children is very hard. Now that relates to the question of whether there are Jewish children to adopt or not. If there were Jewish children to adopt, then it would be much less of a serious issue. But there doesn't seem to be, from what I can tell, the only time I've been involved, there seems to be a very, very long waiting list to adopt Jewish children. There was an old fight about this because of the Asufi and Shtuki issue of Mamzeret, but pretty much we've decided now Jews do adopt Jews, and there's a long waiting list. And secondly, people who have demonstrated communal commitment already and have demonstrated that commitment since they were sincere from birth. Right, that's a real issue, right? People, they're really serious committed Jews. They're not going to leave the Jewish community anyway. they're moser nefesh for Judaism, right? They serve in the IDF, right? Americans who go volunteer in the IDF, right? They pay, you know, $100,000 a year to give their children Jewish education. As a parent of children, of more and more school-aged children who pay higher and higher tuition, it's chatzayani maskir hayom. I used not to appreciate what degree of commitment it took to give your children a Jewish education. Now I understand, because if I chose not to, then I would be an entirely different income bracket. And so that's a huge decision. It's a tremendous amount of commitment. And to tell people who've done that, we recently had a case of somebody who was head of a major Jewish education project. And then you discover at some point that just maybe their mother didn't have a halachic conversion. Or two cases very recently, a student learning in yeshiva all of a sudden discovered that their parents had Orthodox conversions, but that might not meet the contemporary standards because their parents were never shomrot Shabbat and never intended to be. So those kind of cases are right, those kind of, but even though their parents have now, right, you know, raised children through 12 years of Jewish day school and sent them to yeshiva, but they were never shomrot Shabbat. And to tell them, well, you can convert happily, and then you have to relate to your mother, right? But you have to go through the pain of saying that your mother is not really your mother, and all sorts of things. Very, very difficult. Those cases really bother me. On the other hand, and the racism issue really bothers me. I really want Judaism to be built on responsibility. On the other hand, one of the issues that really comes to me is I have converts who have gone through really hard work for. I'm wrapping up. They've gone through really hard work. You know, let's say they spent 2 years, right, going through agony and going to visiting communities and staying with families and all that. And at the end, they demonstrate their sincerity and we convert them. And they look at me and they say, "And so and so, right? So and so, right? So and so, they were right. They married somebody Jewish." And you know, and they basically wandered in. You said, "Well, it didn't make any sense not to convert them. They're going to be Jewish anyway. They look committed, right?" So when you lower conversion standards for some people, you really cheapen the process that people who went with real commitment had. And that's an issue that really has to be addressed. I get that statement from people who've been through our Beit Din and went through a very hard process, and they go to shuls somewhere else, and they meet somebody who's been converted by somebody with much lower standards, and they come back to you and they say, you know, it's not. They're not angry at you for making them go through it, right? They're angry at the other rabbi for making what they did seem meaningless. You didn't really have to do that, and that's an issue that really has to be considered. And again, the Rav Yaakov issue comes both ways. The last thing I want to just point out is, my vision of conversion built off the Mount Sinai thing is recognize that one element of the original model of conversion is that all the Jews took an oath to keep the Torah at Sinai. And the interesting thing is we don't require converts to take an oath. Why not if they're recreating what happened at Sinai? And the answer is that, I think, is that converts have to be assimilated into the commitment of the Jewish people, not making a private commitment. And that leaves room for more flexibility in the sense that if they really see themselves as part of the Jewish people and bound by all those obligations, you can allow for intellectual error as to what those obligations are, so long as it doesn't reach the giggle test. But if their intellectual error is that the obligations binding upon Jews are to confess faith in it, right, in a Messiah who died several thousand years ago, right, that would, I think, be extreme for me, even if they really identified as part of the Jewish people. So my bottom line probably would be that we should maintain high standards for adults, lower them for children, and leave a lot of room for intellectual error among converts. That would be where my policy suggestions would be, but again, you have to make your own decisions about what the policy should be, and everything has to be framed in terms of the politically possible. I think my time runs out now, and I hope I should do an advertisement for myself. If you like this kind of analysis combined with tremendously rigorous halachic analysis, where you do them both together, which I haven't done tonight, you should come learn with me in the summer as part of the Summer Beit Midrash, where you can talk to Yael Klausner about who has been there the past two summers, and various other people who have learned with me in other contexts. Look up TorahLeadership.org. Be in touch. I hope support to hearing from you. Thank you for that. Turn my back so someone can raise their hand.
Well,
sure.
I think that the first thing, the question is whether there are Haredi conversions that don't reflect traditional Jewish values. I would frame it, I would frame it differently. The notion that non-Orthodox rabbis have lower standards than Haredi rabbis is, on the whole, false. What I would say is that there is a group of Haredi rabbis who have very high standards of a certain form. There's also a group of Haredi rabbis who have minimal standards. And in every group, there are people who claim to have standards but don't actually maintain them. There are people who our Beit Din has turned down who have gone and found Haredi Beit Din in a small town somewhere. There are different levels of standards. For example, our Beit Din tends to be very mocked on psychological health. Other Beit Din don't seem to care about this at all. There are Beit Din that use handwriting analysis as part of their, I don't know if that's a lower or higher standard. There are certainly conversions by Haredi Beit Din that I would never do l'chatchila. Whether I would choose to invalidate a conversion done by people who I recognize as halachically competent to make decisions because I disagreed with them, to actually invalidate it. So I would say, post facto, right, it seems to me that there are so many prohibitions against being mean to Gerim. So many, right? 36, whatever the Rambam, I forget the number the Rambam gives you. That if somebody might genuinely be Jewish, there's a good chance that they're Jewish because I have a particular shita to violate onat hager, to violate oppressing somebody who, according to the legitimate position, is a convert. I have a very hard time. Doing that, if the person participated in the process honestly, and the person who converted them arrived at an honest, plausible halachic position, just because I disagree with it. If somebody paid $10,000, that's a difficult thing. Would I like to set as a standard that all converts, for example, have to reject racist rhetoric? Yeah, I would like to set that as a standard. Can I do it in practice? Probably not. No. Well, it was a shame to go for it. You're in charge. I think everyone understands these conversations. I think everyone understands their interests. They don't necessarily share the values, right? They don't necessarily share the values. But I think everyone understands these kinds of issues. Where there is resistance, and I think it's legitimate resistance, is for somebody saying, because I hold this that this ought to be, therefore I have to paskin like this shita as against that shita. Right? What I was trying to do tonight is to say that, recognize that even if you paskin like that sheet, like Shita X, there are still solutions you can come up with. Right? So it's important to know what you think ought to be, even though that means sometimes, let's say, for example, that restaurant, so I think what ought to be is it ought to be under Ahar Shkacha, but it's not. Right? I'm not changing the psak of our Beit Din. Other places, I'll give another example for our Beit Din. Right? So our Beit Din in Boston has a tradition that we follow the psaka of Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, that people with civil or non-Orthodox marriages need to get to divorce. Okay, this is a famous machlokas between Rav Moshe and Rav Yosef Eliezer Henkin, if you know it through Rav Moshe's Truba. Right? It's actually a much broader machlokas. Rav Henkin's position is more nuanced. Let's take it that way. Okay, the position of our Beit Din is that way. So what happens if somebody comes to our Beit Din, right, who has an unorthodox marriage, their spouse refuses to accept or give them a get? Are they an aguna? Well, if the only issue I raised is, what's the psak of our Beit Din? The answer is yes, they're an aguna. But the policy of our Beit Din is, now, that right, is that all such cases are referred to a Beit Din that paskens like Rav Moshe. Now, right, now we had to first have the conversation about whether we think that such people ought to be agunot. Then it turns out that if we think such people ought not to be agunot, that in our particular masoret, there is no way to avoid that. But nobody tells us that we have to paskin those cases. Now, there are a set of cases where I know I have idiosyncratic psakim that I cannot intellectually hold any other way, but that are not necessarily the right psak for the community or for particular people, and I tell them to ask somebody else the shayla. If somebody comes and asks me whether they can kasher their grandmother's set of china. So I have not yet been convinced that the position of the Bali Itur that the OU uses, right, is legitimate. Right, I'm willing to paskin that you can let the china dishes stay for a year and then eat off them. But the OU does. So when somebody asks me that shayla, I don't say, no, I'm sorry, you have to sell them on eBay. And who knows, maybe they use Basar B'Challah, so they're Asar B'Hanas, so you can't even give them the goodwill, you have to smash them. Right? I tell them, go call the OU. Right? It's important to know. I think that people understand that conversation. The danger is that people think that if there's only one conversation. And you really have to realize there are two conversations. Right? There's a conversation, right? You don't have to hold that, if you hold the Shemitah's Deoraisa, that Mechira probably doesn't work. And you can't say, because I think that Zionism has to be true, therefore I have to hold the Shemitah is Derabbanan. But once you hold Shemitah is Derabbanan, you can think of the Heter Mechira.
At the beginning of this discourse, you weren't saying our discussion from the point of view of the trying to create an immigration policy.
Yeah.
But I suppose we're living in the, Moloch state where the Torah is a constitution and we have based in running things.
Mm-hmm.
You have that in a situation. So would you seem, by calling an immigration policy, would you now say that we're not, this now, halakhic state is now not even going to accept people into the borders unless it converts halakhically?
No, because we have an immigration policy for non-Jews. It's called Ger Toshav. Right? Halakha has a very...
I'm not familiar with this.
A Ger Toshav halakhically is a person, is a non-Jew with a green card. Right, it's fundamentally right. Halacha actually has a category for geographic residents. Now, that is a category which you can which doesn't exist so much in the international Jewish community. We haven't, as a de jure principle, as a de facto principle, it's what lets us treat Gentiles humanely in many ways. But if we had a state, then sure we would construct categories of residents like that, and we have plenty of halachic precedent for that. Whoever,
yeah. When I converted, I did a program through like a year and a half, through Sukhothadati.
Mm-hmm.
And like 2 years ago, I found out that there's a program that's for two months through the Israeli, the army rabbinate. And it didn't upset me so much, but I sort of wondered to myself, is this really serving the body's real need? Because 300 years from now, you'll have all these people and you want them to be Jewish, right? So, I mean, it's, people are going to intermarry, they're not going to know whose great grandparents were Jewish or who were not. So, does a certain place still need to convert them? Rabbi Cardoza says that, you should have a separate community somewhere, of these quasi Jews. But, what's the.
I think that's a real issue. If you don't like it, you talk about the area of Rav. Right, the mixed multitude that came out of Egypt with the Jews that in the Midrashic tradition is blamed for all the major sins.
Right, and
you can talk about that, and then you can also look through history and talk about all the important, talk about all the important ways in which converts contributed to the Jewish community. I have a personal bias in that my life and the life of my family has been tremendously enriched by our association with particular converts. So we are.
Converts don't necessarily have the intention to convert, but you're
Right. So again, I think, you know, sometimes they don't do any good, and sometimes their kids turn out to be really important. Right? You know, they really, some, you know, it's tough to know the answer to that. I think that's why we're, you know, that's why you have to have the conversation, not just about halacha, what the policy is, but I don't tell you that I have the answer. You know, my instinct is that we should, that if we could, we should try to have fairly high standards for adults. That would be my instinct. But, you know, but at the same time, it's hard when, you know, again, this is an interest where, you know, sort of Reuven Feinstein, a part of the Haredi, you know, Eternal Jewish Family Organization, thinks that there's a mitzvah to convert all the intermarried spouses because of, you're saving the Jewish partner from sinning. Right? That's his real interest. I don't really, you know, take that as a major interest. But that generates a tremendous lowering of standards. Right? You're looking for, one way of framing it is, sometimes you're looking for stable commitment. Right? That's one issue. Other times, other policies, what you're looking for is a moment where they're committed enough that you can convert them. Right, so they're looking for, to some degree, I think, for intermarried spouses, they're looking for the moment when they can convert them. I feel that way about patrilineals. I have a patrilineal Jew, a patrilineal child who's always identified as Jewish. I'm not looking for whether they'll be frum in 20 years. I'm looking for them to be frum enough that I can honestly convert them now. Right now in America, I think that in the modern Orthodox community, standards on the whole are pretty high. But again, but if you want somebody to be converted who can't, right? If you have cases where there's somebody, well, you know what? It's really better if they're converted, but they don't meet your standards. Everybody knows the three Batei Din that you can send them to that will convert them more leniently. And if they don't meet that either, everybody knows the place you can send them where they can buy the conversion. So it's tough to answer that question. You know, are there, right, you know, and do all the people who buy, are all the people who buy conversion necessarily insincere? No, maybe they just want to get converted in 4 months because they really just want to be, you know, they really just want to be able to live with their husband or what. You know, so I don't think that the epidemic that is used as an excuse for imposing standards, where they claim, you know, where local shul rabbis all across the country are getting together, right, are getting together a little batei din with, right, that I think doesn't happen anymore. But we do have to be aware that it did happen en masse in the 60s and 70s. And one of the issues that we're addressing is, let's say the RCA took the position that it does not automatically accept the converts of past members, especially if they served as rabbis in non-mechitza shuls. Now that causes enormous human suffering, and is not really responsible to them. But on the other hand, I can tell you it caused enormous human suffering because I get lots of cases, and that must mean it happened a lot. I don't think that happens anymore. I really don't. But on the other hand, I would tell you that, you know, there was a conversion recently, one of the independent minyanim, right? One of the, you know, the independent, the Tehillah Darchei Noam, right? So a group of people from there got together and did a conversion recently. So who knows what's going to happen? Okay, thank you very, very much. The pleasure. I'm leaving brochures and business cards. Hopefully there'll be an email at some point that gives you the chance to get in touch as well. And I encourage you strongly to look at thoroughleadership.org, talk to Al, and I hope that we'll have a chance to learn together often in the future.
We have about a 20-minute break or so, and then we'll continue with the discussion portion of the evening, so feel free to grab a drink, run to the bathroom, and hang out.
Right.
Don't forget more food. There's a lot more food.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Man has questions.
Is there a safe harbor? They can prevent from zeros for 10 generations.
Shama and Kay had a similar problem. They couldn't marry each other. But they managed.
Well, that's what the Shama has plastic.
But he gave an excellent discussion.
Really, you just picked it all up and you never mind. I think a very spirited presentation.
Take the stairs just one floor down, you'll see it. Take a left, take the stairs one floor down, you'll see it.
Are you ever heard of that? Yeah, I'm gonna have a I do want to know an update about what you actually said, or was that
They're fracking issue with it.